Interlude 2. The Future and the Past. Back at Cambridge, over a decade after his fateful expedition to Principe, Arthur Eddington found himself sitting before the fire in the senior combination room at Trinity College, along with Ernest Rutherford, the director of Cambridge's greatest physics lab, and a handful of other guests. The topic of fame came up, of public celebrity, and one young guest asked why in the previous few years Einstein had had so much public acclaim, while hardly anyone among the general public knew who Rutherford was, despite his Nobel Prize. After all, it was Rutherford more than anyone who'd uncovered the inner structure of the atom.
"Well, it's your fault, Eddington," Rutherford teased. Not everyone immediately grasped his meaning. All present, including the bright young Indian researcher who would later relate the story, knew that Eddington's dramatic presentation at the Royal Society in November 1919 had had some effect on Einstein's reputation, but why had it been so overwhelming? The men settled into their deep chairs, and Rutherford spoke more reflectively this time. The war had just ended when Eddington announced the results of his study, Rutherford recalled. Astronomy had always appealed to the public imagination. Now people learned that an astronomical prediction by a German scientist had been confirmed by British expeditions prepared while the two countries were at war to Brazil and West Africa. Harmony was possible. True peace was possible. The discovery struck a responsive chord, Rutherford concluded, and then the typhoon of publicity crossed the Atlantic. And a typhoon it was, for what had happened to Einstein after that Royal Society meeting was unprecedented, unimaginable even, at least at the time. It began, as many things do nowadays, in the media. The London Times had been moderately restrained in its coverage of the meeting, but the same could not be said for its many counterparts across the pond. Although the New York Times had some excellent reporters, the best one it could get to London for the Burlington House meeting on short notice was Henry Crouch, the paper's main golf correspondent, who'd thought he was going to be spending his time in Britain at St. Andrews and similar beguiling links. He would have been the first to admit that he was very much not an authority on the mathematics of four-dimensional space-time. Crouch did, however, work out that something extraordinary had occurred, and his enthusiasm was transmitted to the New York Times headline writers. Hence, just 6 days after the big meeting, the newspaper reported, "Lights all askew in the heavens. Men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observations. Einstein theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or were calculated to be, but nobody need worry. A book for 12 wise men. No more in all the world could comprehend it," said Einstein when his daring publishers accepted it. The headline was appropriately breathless, but impressively incorrect. The stars were exactly where Einstein had predicted. That was indeed the whole point of the expedition. Crouch had never spoken to Einstein, and had made up the quote about only a dozen men being able to understand the theory. None of that mattered. Rutherford was right about people liking the international harmony that Eddington's expedition had demonstrated. There had been some other examples of cooperation after the war, in exploration and medicine, yet Einstein alone was given an open top car parade before tens of thousands in the United States, saw massive lecture halls filled hours before he appeared in Prague and Vienna, and was mobbed at movie premieres. When he was home in Berlin, letters constantly arrived, hundreds of them, and then thousands. They were delivered in such volumes that Einstein once had a dream in which he couldn't breathe, for the postman was roaring at me, hurling bundles of letters. It helped that Einstein had an informality that contrasted with the snobbery of the upper classes who had led the world during the Great War. Reporters loved the fact that once, when he was arriving to give a grand address at the University of Vienna, officials at the railway station waited and waited for the great man to emerge from the first-class compartment. Then, shades of Max von Lauer's visit to the patent office in 1907, they saw a familiar shape far down the platform, walking contentedly along on his own, from the third-class car he had taken, violin case in one hand, briar pipe and suitcase in the other. But there were further reasons for the fame. Looking upward to the stars can be felt to be the same as looking upward to the divine. Mankind had always wanted to understand the ways of God, to know why chaos occurs, and how the meanings we want to believe lie behind it could be found. And this, the world was convinced, was what one quiet, thoughtful Swiss-German physicist had discovered. Most of all, however, Einstein's fame was as a result of the trauma the world had just endured. Millions of men had died in the Great War, and innumerable families had lost a father, a son, a husband. There was a need to find some way back. Seances became popular, even though they were repeatedly shown to be run by charlatans. It was too painful to think that the dead were so completely gone that no contact, not even a whisper, could be maintained. An alternative seemed more plausible than it might have in earlier times, for homeowners were beginning to install large electrically operated machines, the first radios, in kitchens and living rooms, and through these devices one could hear voices that had travelled invisibly over long distances. Who knew what else might be invisibly travelling, waiting somewhere beyond? This is what Einstein's work also seemed to promise, for he showed that at least some forms of time travel are definitely possible. Before Einstein, it was taken for granted that we live in three dimensions, and that quite separately, at right angles to that, one might say, there is a fourth dimension of time, which we move through at a steady, unchanging forward rate. Einstein transformed all this. The reasoning that led to his prediction of starlight bending as it neared the sun also leads to this prediction that time bends, depending on how strong gravity is around it. Usually we don't notice this, because the effects are very slight in the fairly weak and uniform gravity around us on Earth, and at the speeds, so much less than the speed of light, with which we move about. But Einstein had unveiled this unsuspected truth about time, and with the success of Eddington's expedition, everyone now learned that he was right. In particular circumstances, some of us can travel forward through time, can be sped into the future at greater rates than others. Strange implications follow from the facts of nature that Einstein discovered. Think what might happen when our explorer, who was kidnapped by space pirates and dragged at high speeds through the galaxy, is finally rescued. The explorer has been living within time that, from his perspective, is moving more slowly than that of his rescuers. The rescuers have been living within time that, from their perspective, is moving more quickly than his. Of course, if they manage to free him from the space pirates without much delay, there will be little chance for that difference to build up. But if the pirates haul him around on a huge roundabout journey before the rescuers finally reach him, they might be decades older, while he, undergoing sufficient acceleration, will have aged only a few days. If his journey has seen truly tremendous acceleration, he might be just a week older when he's found, but the original rescuers will have long since died, and it will be their distant descendants who greet him. This mind-bending stuff isn't merely imagined, postulated, unproven. Einstein showed that the effect is not just on our measuring machinery, but in reality itself. A traveller to the stars could return after what to him was genuinely no more than 2 or 3 years. But while he would still be a young man, millennia would have passed on Earth, and everyone he knew, possibly even the civilization he'd left, would have long since vanished. Were these effects to be magnified so that they were noticeable even at the ordinary speeds and in the usual gravitational fields we're accustomed to on Earth, someone driving fast enough to an exercise class would be in the car for only 1 minute by his measurement, while his friends waiting for him there would be watching him drive for half an hour of their time. Parents who could afford to rent apartments on the very top floors of tall skyscrapers, where gravity is weaker, would age much more slowly than children they'd left in boarding schools on the ground. They could pass a single week up there, while their children trundled through all the years from primary school to graduation. These were the sorts of results that prompted such baffled comments as that from the distinguished scientist and Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann.
"Einstein explained his theory of relativity to me for weeks, and by the end I was convinced that he understood it."
But Eddington's findings showed that somehow, extraordinarily, relativity was true. Distant starlight didn't veer around the sun only because space itself was sagging. Rather, time was operating at different rates as well. This is hard to envisage, but imagine incoming starlight being made up of a row of light beams, all rushing forward in parallel like a row of sprinters. The ones on the outside get a longer time to advance a given distance, and so, like the runners taking a banked curve, that's why the entire row begins to swerve. How much further could Einstein's insights go? The fact that with the right technology we could accelerate into the future was impressive. But after the Great War, many people would have given anything to be able to travel in the other direction, to the past. If not to bring back lost life, then to get more time, even if just one final hour with those they loved, before a bullet or a shell brought them down. Although some recent developments of Einstein's work have suggested that it may in fact be possible to travel backwards in time, in the immediate aftermath of Eddington's expedition, no physicists, not even Einstein, saw how to do that. But they did, even at that time, appreciate another solace-giving implication of his theory. Not quite the ability to travel into the past, but not quite an acceptance that those we love are entirely lost, either. In the world before Einstein, everyone believed that, of course, two events that one person finds simultaneous have to be just as simultaneous for everyone else. But Einstein's work revealed that this is not so. Even several years after World War I ended, by our reckoning of time, there were locations beyond our galaxy from which the vast numbers of deaths in the trenches and on other battlefields had not yet occurred. This was not just an artifact of measurement or a fantasy of the mystics, as with William Blake's "I see the past, present, and future existing all at once before me." If we could be in one of those far-off locations right now, we too would be living at a time when a friend or husband who had been shot was still alive. The catch, however, was that those perspectives involved such tremendous speeds and relative accelerations that Einstein's equation showed we would never be able to access them, since we could never travel fast enough to get there. Present-day technologies could bring us nowhere near the required speeds. Still, the knowledge that such realities were possible, even if only on a theoretical level, gave comfort to many, including Einstein himself. Many years later, when his friend Michele Besso died, and he himself was 76, with heart and other health problems, and knowing his own end was near, he wrote to Besso's family of the deep understanding he drew from this view. "Now he has preceded me briefly in his departure from this strange world. This means nothing.
For those of us who believe in physics, the distinction between past, present, and future is only an illusion, however tenacious this illusion may be.
Despite, or more likely because of, its ballooning popular appeal, much of Einstein's theoretical work became distorted in popular understanding. Almost immediately after Eddington's results were publicised, books, lectures, and radio broadcasts went out about the great man's work, many of which got his theories wrong. But enough of what Einstein had achieved made its way through. No other scientist had ever been so acclaimed, even if no one, not Rutherford, not Einstein himself, could be sure why that was the case. Yet, whatever the reasons, practically overnight, multitudes of people came to think of Einstein as someone who had seen what mankind had never imagined, who had reached into the heavens and brought down, if not salvation, at least a glimpse of what deeper reality there might be.